The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
There's really a process here in terms of the Aseret HaDibrot, right? Again, I don't know that we need the text because it's all of two words, but just to be, you know, efficient, right? Essentially, what does it say, right? And there's a list of these things. And it's very interesting, by the way, when you look in the text, right, that it's almost like the Torah paints them as connected, right? Look at this, right? I would have thought that even though the Torah only gives me two words on murder, at least have the decency to give it its own verse. Okay? Lo tirtzach, don't, that should be a whole separate verse. So you'll tell me, well, two words doesn't the verse make, but that's ridiculous. A verse, a pasuk, is an idea contained. And if lo tirtzach is a world unto itself, then it should be contained in a pasuk. But take a look. Lo tirtzach, lo tinaf, lo tignov, lo tanev re'achai tshaker. Those four things, we're going to get to the fourth next week. Don't murder, don't adulter, and don't steal. They're all part of one verse, okay? And they're painted, if you think about it, in the same literary styles. I have to say that there's a progression here. So think about this, because what's really the connection, before we even get into specifically what, you know, sort of lo tignov is, murder, if you think about it, is the taking of life. Adultery is the taking of love, and we describe what love is. And theft is the taking of property. And these are, if you think about it, three principal motivations of man. Thomas Mann wrote about the connection between life, love, and property. Right? If you think about it, life, love, and liberty, which is sort of the cadre of the American Revolution, liberty is really about property. I'm free. There are different definitions as to what freedom is, and we'll get to that. One level of understanding freedom is that I'm free to own what I want. Now, we'll get to this in a second. But there is a progression here. And what's interesting is, once I can take life, then it becomes possible for me to take love. I would have thought the opposite. I would have thought the order here should be the opposite. That first, it becomes easiest to take property. And once you can take property, then you can take love. Once you can take love, then you can take life. I would have thought that murder, once you can't murder, right? I mean, once you can transgress and steal, then it becomes more possible for you to murder. The flip way of looking at this is, it's only when you recognize the principle on which murder is based that you're ready to receive the principle of adultery and vice versa. So let's talk about what this is. Why is lo tignov one of the big ten? Why is this such a major tenet in Judaism? I remember once I was standing in a supermarket, one of these big supermarkets, right? And this woman starts screaming, "Thief! Thief!" And I turn around and she's pointing right at me, right? "Thief! Thief!" Now, you know, and everybody turns and starts looking. I'm thinking, like, what could I have done? What, you know, did I bang into her? Did something fall out of her pocket? Did I take something she was reaching for and put it in my cart, you know? It took me a minute to realize she was blind. Somebody had, like, taken something from her and walked off. And I guess she discovered that the healthy reaction to do is just to point thief and maybe it would force whoever it was to. But it was a horrible feeling. You know, this feeling of having taken something that isn't yours, even if you haven't taken it, right? What does it mean to steal? Now, we generally assume that theft is about taking property that isn't yours. And you have to understand, there's a general question that has to do with the concept of any particular mitzvah, not specific to this one. You see this, for example, on Shabbat, with the issue of pikuach nefesh, which means the saving or the paramount importance of a life, right? Let's say someone is sick, okay? And let's say they're so sick that their life is in danger. So obviously you're allowed to cook for them on Shabbat, because if that's what's necessary to heal them, if there's even the possibility that that's going to save their life, then you have to cook for them on Shabbat. The question is why? Do you cook for them on Shabbat because you're allowed to transgress something which is essentially prohibited in order to save a life? In other words, it's still forbidden to cook on Shabbat, But you're allowed to do the forbidden because there's something more important that allows you to violate something that's forbidden. That's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is, no, if you're saving someone's life, that's not called the prohibition of cooking on Shabbat. The act of cooking on Shabbat for saving someone's life is not the same act as cooking something which is prohibited. And it not only becomes permitted, it actually becomes a mitzvah. And the way that the rabbis define this in halachic terminology is the word d'chuya, which means that it's pushed off. I push off a prohibition, in other words, I allow a prohibition. Or hutra, the prohibition becomes permitted. It actually becomes almost a mitzvah. Right? Same is true here. Is the definition of theft the taking of property? Right? And are there certain instances when I'm allowed to do that which is prohibited, to take property? Or can I learn the definition of theft as the taking of property from the instances where I'm actually allowed to take by virtue of the fact that it's no longer called taking? Right? Best example I can think of, I told you this, so I put this out in the parasha. I met once a fascinating fellow. He's a Holocaust survivor. And came over at the end of a lecture. And to make a long story short, he always had a struggle with kleptomania. As a kid, he used to get into tremendous trouble because he just had this urge to take. As strange as this may seem, and we always assume that this is educational, sometimes kids are born with this. Now, kleptomania is actually a disease. It can be, somehow I don't fully understand it, an impact that makes an impression on you. And you can be born with this. And there are ways of treating it, just like all sorts of other, you know, phobias, right? And this kid used to get in tremendous trouble as a kid. He grew up in Berlin, and he would always be pilfering things and taking things in class and always getting into trouble. And he never understood why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he grew up in a firm home, religious home, why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu, why did God curse him with this challenge to always be, to always want to steal, etc. Until the Holocaust came along. And he was in, I think it was Berlin, but I could be wrong. By 1935, 1936, things had gotten significantly worse for the Jews. And one of the things that the Nazis did very early on was to send out invitations, quote unquote, to all of the Jewish populace to come visit Gestapo headquarters. And what they did was they issued them new identity papers. Every Jew, I don't know if you know this, every Jew by 1936 had to be renamed. Okay, men were named Abraham and women were named Sarah. Now the reason that they did this was so that, you know, someone could look at your identity papers in an instant and see that you're Jewish. Right? Beyond just the description of Jew. Right? And it was a way of further degrading and humiliating the Jews, and it was an excuse for them to bring them in and to round them up and to do all sorts of other horrible things. So this fellow got his calling. He was 15, 16 years old, called into Gestapo headquarters. There was a large group of people that were, you know, sort of in line, and then eventually he got inside and he was sitting in a door and he was quaking in his boots. By this time, to be sitting as a Jew in Gestapo headquarters was a terrifying experience. And he described that there was sort of a vestibule. There was a sort of an outer hallway, right? And they were waiting in this outer hallway, right? And there was like a counter. And beyond this counter, you could see a whole series of sort of desks where people would sit, the policemen, whatever. And then there was a corridor that led apparently back to some back rooms and maybe some cells, right? And so they were standing in this vestibule, and they could see over the counter to this area where there were all these desks. And he was watching a particular fellow who was being interrogated by a Gestapo policeman. And the Gestapo was screaming at him, "Dein Namen, what's your name?" And the Jew would answer, you know, "Morris." And the man would hit him and say, "What's your name? Dein Namen." And the Jew would look around and panic. He wouldn't be sure what he was supposed to say. And they would begin to hit him and to beat him until finally the Jew understood he was supposed to say Abraham. And they would sit down in their chair and sort of gather themselves together and go back to being civilized. Then they would say, "Well, what's the name of the whore who bore you?" Which is how they would say it. They wouldn't say your mother. And they would go through this again. And he looked around this room, five or six desks. And at each desk, there was a different person being interrogated, beaten, screamed at, interrogated. And he was trying to learn the pattern. And he realized that no matter what he was going to do, he was in for a beating. And at a certain point, the Gestapo would get up and he would tell this person to come with them, and they would drag the person back, and sometimes someone else would come along, and they would drag, and then instantly you would begin to hear screams and yells as they would take them off to some back cell, beat them, and maybe throw them in the cell for a while, etc. And he's standing at this counter, and he's literally becoming white with fear, realizing he's a 14-year-old boy. We don't have this perception. We can't even begin to comprehend walking to a police station and recognizing that the possibility is that you're never going to walk out again. And so I can't even begin to relate to how terrifying this must feel. At a certain point, it just so happens that five or six of these individuals, right, are all dragged up and in the back rooms. And the whole front area of desks is empty. And he sees that on one of the front desks is a pile of passports. And he recognized that his passport was put on top of that pile. And he gets this sudden urge, because that's his urge. And he looks around, he doesn't see anybody, he just can't resist. And he walks behind the counter, and he walks up to the desk, and he takes the entire pile of passports and identity papers, looks around at the other desks, fills his shirt with all the ones that he could find, and just walks out of Gestapo headquarters. And he said that from that moment, he never had this desire, this unhealthy desire to steal again. It was almost as if God gave him that desire, that gift for that moment. And he had almost 80 identity papers and passports, and they used them, he said, to forge and to help get Jews out of Germany, etc., right? So we're given, if you think about it, a gift. Now, theft, as an objective reality, is a very complex issue. What defines something as theft or not as theft? You know, if the Torah says lo tignov, right, so it's very much the same as lo tirtzach, don't murder. In order to know what that commandment is, I have to be able to define what it is. Now, with murder, very challenging. You know, you could say you can't take a life, but that's not true. Sometimes it's a mitzvah to take a life, right? Killing a terrorist in a combat operation is probably, if you ask me, a mitzvah. It's not a pleasant mitzvah, but it's a mitzvah, right? I'm going to put aside lo tinaf for a moment, because that's an interesting question, how I define adultery. And it's only when we get through these three that we'll be able to go back and sort of take a closer look at this. Because we assume that lo tinaf is that I don't adulter, meaning that I don't have an extramarital relationship, right? But the truth is there are many, many forms of niuf, right? Adultery doesn't have to mean, God forbid, meeting someone who's married and going off to some hotel room. You can adulter in many different ways. You can adulter with what you think, you can adulter with how you behave, you can adulter with what you choose to do. In fact, the greatest and the most challenging adultery is not the adultery we do to or in spite of or alongside someone else. It's the adultery we do to ourselves. Think about it. Why is it, we spoke about this last time, why is it that I'm given a particular relationship, for whatever the reason, that's the relationship Hashem gives to me, and that relationship is the relationship I'm meant to work on, and that experiencing or attempting to experience anything similar to that relationship with another is considered out of bounds? Why is that? It's because this relationship means that this is my purpose, right? If you marry a certain person, you know, as sort of the paradigm of adultery, if you marry a certain person, now for whatever reason Hashem gave this person to you in your life, and you've made a commitment that with this person you're going to create a home, you're going to create a partnership, you're going to change the world. And if you negate that, then ultimately on a certain level you're negating what Hashem has given you, right? Now there are ways to do that. So now translate that. Imagine that you're put on this earth for a purpose. I mean, that is the greatest challenge. You know, way back when we were having a discussion about the first Dibra, we were talking about sort of what the challenges are vis-a-vis atheism. And I said, you can't prove that God exists, and you can't prove that atheism is wrong, right? But at the very least, there were certain challenges, certain logical questions that I personally struggled with, which sort of led me to conclude that atheism can't be the most logical explanation for the existence of the universe. And one of them was that if God created the world, then that means nothing is random and everything has purpose. If God didn't create the world, there's no creation, everything is random. But that leaves you with a tremendous challenge. Because if everything in this world is created, and therefore everything has purpose, then what makes the world worth living, what makes the world worth meaning, what gives me my meaning, is trying to discern what that purpose is. You can go a little nuts from this. Right? If you see a child, and he's taking this, Now, to you and I, this looks like a coffee cup, right? But a two-year-old has no idea what this is. So he thinks this is a hammer. And he's very excited. And that's what he thinks. He's not wrong to think that. This could logically be a hammer. It's got that, you know, sort of... I mean, maybe that's just a boy's way of looking at things, right? So you walk in one day, and he's taking your nice coffee mug, and he's banging something because that's what he's doing. Right? So the process of educating that child is not about you're bad. It's not even about you're wrong, although that's where it starts. It's about, I want to teach you what the real purpose for this is. And that's his process of learning. His process of learning is discovering what the different purposes for the different things are. You know? Even time has different purposes. This is the hardest thing I know, you know, with Yair. To Yair, life would be great if it was always recess. It's a challenge to sort of teach children that times have different purposes, right? That a chair has a purpose, right? That chalk has a purpose and there are purposes it doesn't have. You know? And we confuse children on certain levels sometimes by giving them items that we tell them have a different purpose and using them for this purpose. Like, for example, when you give kids sidewalk chalk, right? So don't get me wrong, I'm not on a crusade against sidewalk chalk. Somebody got it for us. I gave it to my kids. They had a great time. It's a brilliant idea. But it has an educational challenge because you've just taught your kids that they can draw on your driveway. And you don't want them to translate that into lots of other different meanings. So you're challenged by teaching them that it has a very specific purpose and doesn't have other purposes. You can't use it to draw on the floor in the house, etc. Right? Now translate this to its ultimate. Can I define my purpose? Can I figure out what my purpose is? And if I have a purpose in this world and I don't find it and I don't live up to it, then I'm adulting on myself. And that is the deepest, the most challenging, and the most damaging form of adultery. And it leads to all the other challenges that we have. And this is something we need, all of us, to reevaluate all the time. Am I living up to who I'm meant to be? Am I living up to the love relationship that I was given in this world with myself, with HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Which leads you back to Lo Tignov. So how do you define stealing? Just like you can't say that murder is just taking life, how do you define it? If you needed to come up with a definition for what theft is, what would it be? Let's see. How would you define theft?
Take something that doesn't belong to you.
Take something that doesn't belong to you. And yet this fellow standing in this room, not only do I think that his theft was okay, I think it was a mitzvah. And he definitely took something that didn't belong to him. Right?
Right.
By any technical definition. In fact, that was one of I once read through a whole bunch of transcripts from the Nuremberg trials. You can actually see, there's a case, one of the judges, I forget his name, Spitzer, I think, in the Nuremberg trials, okay? One of the categories of criminals that were sort of less well known, because everybody looks at the big, you know, sort of 13, the Hermann Gorings and the Julius Streichers, etc. But they also put a good number of judges on trial at Nuremberg. That's why the trials took almost a year and a half. And some of these trials, in fact, there was a movie made about one of these trials. I don't know if you ever saw it. I forget the name, but it was with Burt Lancaster. Mm. And Spencer Tracy. It's a brilliant movie. Spencer Tracy plays sort of the head judge advocate on a military court at Nuremberg. And Burt Lancaster plays a German judge who finally is forced to confront just how horrible he has abused the gift that he was given of being a judge. And at one point in the movie, one of the witnesses looks at Burt Lancaster, who's supposed to be a judge, and he basically says to him, "You're supposed to be there to defend the weak and the innocent. You're supposed to represent truth. Where were you? Where were you?" So there's a case in the Nuremberg trials of a particular theft in which a Jew was actually caught stealing food. And the Nazis, this was early on, you know, they wanted to make an example. And this person actually went to a court. And the judges sentenced him, right, to some extreme sentence. I think it was hard labor. He ended up in a camp and he was killed. And one of the relatives, who actually wasn't Jewish, who had been struggling to sort of get this person freed, came to testify at the end of the case. Did the judges know where they were sending him, etc., 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 right? Here you have an objective act, theft, taking something that isn't yours. So, In other words, you can steal for a good purpose, but not steal for a bad purpose. Let's agree that we're not going to post this up in the hallways of... I want you to know, Robin Hood is a very challenging story. And people don't realize this. The purpose of the writing of Robin Hood was to raise this exact moral issue. Is it so simple to steal from the rich? And did Robin Hood do an in-depth study of every nobleman that came through Nottingham Forest? Right? Do you know? Is it so true that you're allowed to take from the rich and give to the poor? There's a medrash about David HaMelech. And it was in one of these, you know, sort of like the medrash says, or one some children's book. And I remember reading this, I was in elementary school. And I didn't get it. And I remember for years I thought I just didn't understand it. And I just, it was kind of like, every once in a while it would pop up again. And the medrash is that that David HaMelech was presented with a case, and there was a wealthy litigator, and there was a poor litigator. And the David HaMelech, in his great wisdom, realized that the poor man was wrong, and so he found in favor of the rich man, and forced the poor man to pay the wealthy man, right? The prutot that he owed, right? The money that he owed. And I remember looking at this medrash, and it really bothered me. Like, well, what do you mean? How is this some great example of the paragon of who David HaMelech was? Right? So that was obviously the point of the medrash. Right? So how do you define what theft is? So I'll tell you what I think. Maybe the reason that this dibra is put here as only two words, lo tignov, is precisely for this reason. Know that there is a prohibition against stealing, and know that you are absolutely, hopelessly, it's impossible for you to define what this mitzvah is, right? I think maybe the reason that lo tignov is put, I mean, it's such a void. I mean, you expect if God's going to bring up a topic, give us a little meat. You know, imagine you go to a lecture with Tony Robbins, and he stands up, at the beginning of the lecture, he says, well, I can't talk to you, so I'm just going to give a very brief lecture. Right? Good morning. I'm just going to give a very brief lecture, and then we'll take questions. Right? And he stands up and he says, just be sure you're true to yourself. Then he sits down. Now, that's a very deep line. But if you went and paid money to hear Tony Robbins, you'd expect a little more than just be true to yourself. And for all I know, he could give an hour lecture, but that's really the whole point of the lecture and all you walk away with. So it's the same thing. God comes along with a dibra, right? And you expect a little meat. And all it says is lo tignov. I think maybe the idea of lo tignov is that you cannot define this mitzvah without God. In other words, the reason this dibra is placed in the context of these Ten Commandments in this fashion is because know that you cannot define this unless you put it into context. How could you possibly define what stealing is and what stealing isn't? Look at society. Look how many opportunities there are to make theft into a mitzvah. You know? I mean, we still, fortunately, you know, I won't name the yeshiva and I won't name even the family, but I once met someone who, whatever, they lived in a small community, and the parents really wanted their son to go to yeshiva. And they recognized that there was no yeshiva high school in the area. So they sent this boy away to yeshiva high school, you know, somewhere there was a real yeshiva. And somewhere along the lines of ninth grade, they got into a discussion about the concept of dina de malchuta dina, that the law of the land is the law. Right? There's actually a halacha that whatever the law of the land is, that's the law. In other words, unless it contravenes a halacha, in other words, if the American government comes up with a law that you're not allowed to put on tefillin, right? Or that you have to only eat meat that's killed through electro, right? Right. So, well, no, because that doesn't force you to break halacha. You're not breaking halacha if you go outside with a baseball hat. So if there's halacha that says you can't wear a kippah, right? The question is, so that's a separate issue. Are you then allowed to wear a kippah if it's against the law? Probably not. However, if they pass a law that says that you have to wear woolen linen, and that's a prohibition of shatnez, which is a biblical prohibition, then you're allowed to break the law of the land. But with that exception, the law of the land is the law. How far does this go, etc., right? And they got into this discussion, and it became clear that the particular Rebbe who was teaching this issue, right, felt that the reason for dina de malchuta dina, in other words, the question comes up in rabbinic literature, why is the law of the land the law? And there are actually two possibilities. One is that the law of the land the law is because God gives law to man, and if God creates a king and God creates rulers, and they are making law, then that means that they are messengers of God, and you have to follow them. There's a second opinion. The second opinion is no, because you're living under the auspices of a community, and in order to protect yourselves, you as a community have to adhere to the law of the land. Now, if that's the route that you take, then the extension of that is, if you know you're not in danger, you don't really have to listen to the law of the land. For example, are you violating halacha if you go 70 in a 60-mile zone? Are you violating halacha? Very difficult question. And there, I want you to know, there are responsum written about this, or Moshe Tshuva about this, and I finally found the one I liked, right? But one way of looking at this is that within the framework of law, of American law, is that there is a posted speed limit, and that the reason, the basis for that posted speed limit is because that one is not supposed to speed because one endangers the general population, right? And that's the reason why law officers will see a guy going 65 in a 60 miles an hour and they won't stop him. It's not because they're lazy. It's because there's an understanding to what this really represents. But if you're going 62 in a zone and weaving through traffic, even if you're doing it legally, right, they'll stop you because you're endangering, you're recklessly endangering, etc. So this particular rabbi sort of felt that that we live in a society where we're not really in danger, we don't really need the protection of the government, and therefore the issue is only getting caught, that you should be careful to prevent a chilul Hashem, whatever it might be. And therefore there's really nothing wrong. And so one of the kids asked him, well, if you find a way to cheat on your taxes, to not pay taxes, and you know you can get away with it, and they'll never catch you, are you allowed to do it? And the discussion that the boy had with his parents when he got home, it became clear to the parents that the Rebbe was not saying no. So they pulled him out of the school. That's a very difficult question. It's so easy to look around the world and find all sorts of opportunities to steal and not call it stealing. Unless there is an objective authority, unless there is a higher moral ground, which comes from the only source that can be higher than any human being, which is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you'll never be able to get to the root of lo tignov. And today's society is a perfect example. That's issue number one. Issue number two, we're going to have to get to next time, right, is what Judaism does about theft. There is a fascinating and a powerful lesson to be learned from how the Torah reacts to the concept of theft. What the consequences are for theft, what the consequences are not for theft. You know, it's all well and good to say that theft is off. What do you do when you encounter theft? Very interesting. America has a very specific set of laws. Put them in jail. Jail does not seem to work for theft. There just aren't that many criminals who go to jail for stealing and come out and never steal again. So something's off. And of course this deals with the larger issues of all the different things that we can steal. We can steal someone's reputation, we can steal someone's time, we can steal someone's sleep. So we'll take a look at that B'zrat Hashem next time.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.